Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
And welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. We're going to be talking a little bit about healthcare in the news. It's hard to avoid. But also, I really want to encourage you to call in with your questions and comments on various things as we go through the hour. Well, with reference to healthcare, I came across this from April 1st. I thought it was quite interesting. So, between October 2016 and January 2017, visits for IUD prescriptions in the United States were up 21%, and I checked in and they've continued to grow. That has to do with the fact that people of the female persuasion are quite definitely imagining that they may lose access to birth control services. And yes, indeed, on Thursday, the House passed a bill that did remove funding from Planned Parenthood. That's all funding, not just funding for abortions, by the way. So my anticipation is that this will have the effect of creating more, not fewer, unwanted pregnancies. But consistency, internal consistency was never much of a strong suit in Washington. And I think you can agree with me on that, whether you are on the extreme left, the extreme right, or in the extreme middle. Let's talk a little bit about the Medicaid, or rather the American Health Care Act that went through on Thursdays. It's going to eliminate health tax penalties for people who don't have health insurance. It's also going to eliminate the subsidies for people who do have health insurance. So, to quote Ross Perot, I think we're going to experience a massive sucking sound as people withdraw from their health insurance. Of course, that won't include people who are actually sick. And in fact, if you are actually sick or have a health condition, you better keep your job. And you better keep your insurance no matter what they charge you, because some important protections will be eliminated should this become the law of the land. But before we go into the details, I just want to take a broad stroke and point out a couple of numbers. $880 billion and $300 billion. So in over 10 years' time, this bill will result in $880 billion being taken out of Medicaid, which is the health care plan that primarily serves poor families, particularly families where you have a working mom and kids and no dad. It also serves for pregnancy care and prenatal care and well child care. So $880 billion out of that $880 billion, $300 billion will go directly into the pockets of high-income people, particularly employers. It's going to repeal the payroll tax and the investment income tax. So if you're lucky enough to have a stock portfolio, you'll be happy. But that money, I want to point out, is coming from money that is currently being spent on health care for the poor. Now, that will not mean that the poor will suddenly stop having health care needs. What it will mean is that it will drive them into the emergency rooms, which by law are required to take care of them sooner or later. This will lead to some of the most expensive way to provide that care, and therefore it will actually end up costing more, both from the federal standpoint, but primarily this is going to be passed through to anyone who does have health insurance in the form of higher costs for hospital care. Because the money has to come from somewhere, and that's where it can come from. So you can expect those 15 to 20% annual increases in healthcare premiums to continue What will we get in favorable in healthcare premiums? Well, if you don't want maternity care because you are not of an age where you would be having children, you're going to have a drop in your premium because the cost of maternity care was being covered by the entire system. It'll go to being covered only by those who decide that they need maternity care services included in their health insurance plan. And I guess you can make the argument that choosing to have a child is a matter of choice. But I do think making it expensive to have children unless you're already on welfare is perhaps, again, a somewhat short-sighted strategy. In removing the subsidies, one of the other things that allowed this to get passed, by the way, because the Republicans in states like Virginia and Kentucky were worried about being voted out of office when these subsidies went away, what they got as coverage was that you're going to have a tax credit, up to $4,000 a year in tax credits if you're between the ages of 50 and 60. Of course, the premium increase for you is likely to be on the order of $500 to $1,500 a month by most estimates. So you're going to burn through your $4,000 tax credit in about 3 months and be out a net of perhaps $6,000 to $12,000 by the end of the year. This not payable by pre-tax dollars. So it's a really significant hit to the older middle class people, but I guess they are not considered in the political calculus here. Insurance companies will also be able to potentially exclude people with pre-existing conditions. For me, this was one of the biggest advantages to Obamacare was the removal of a deep injustice, which is the following. If you are a person who survived cancer, you are a insurance leper. No one wants to insure you because you might get cancer again. Well, in this case, that's the situation. If you have recovered from cancer, you may be legally excluded from coverage. And if you do live in a state where they don't opt out of that restriction, you might be paying such huge premiums that you won't be able to afford coverage. We're looking at $60,000 a year as what it would cost you for health insurance if you have a expensive pre-existing condition, such as rheumatoid arthritis or a cancer diagnosis, something that's going to interfere with the corporate bottom line at the insurance company. And I would just like to throw this out for as a question, possibly a discussion question. We're going to drop the healthcare issue for the moment, at least for me and my monologue. And my question to you, my audience, is where is it written that insurance companies are supposed to make a profit? Insurance companies traditionally were cooperatives founded to spread the cost over a population. They were, in fact, all nonprofits originally because it made no sense to the people setting them up that there needed to be a corporate dividend to shareholders. So, in fact, none of these had shareholders. Now, they pretty much all do. And, naturally, shareholders want a return on investment. Is this sane? That's my question for you. And if you think it's sane, I'd love to have you call in and let's have a discussion about your read on why this is a good idea, because I'm having real trouble understanding it. And currently I'm in the process of reading a somewhat radical book called An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How We Can Take It Back. This is written by Elizabeth Rosenthal, the editor of Kaiser News, and I'm finding it very informative. She obviously has a position, but so far the first two chapters or so, as far as I've gotten, it's been all about the history of how this happened, and it's a fascinating read. So high marks for it, and you can expect to hear more in the future. We're going to move to some emails. I think we'll start out with this one. This is a big topic, but I've been thinking about it. It comes from Kate in Portland, Oregon. Dr. Dawn, I listened to your podcast on GeekSpeak, and I'm so happy I could cry from joy that you exist. I can honestly say that you've changed my life and my hope for our medical world in the West. Can you please do a podcast on sexual health? I'm a 38-year-old woman madly in love with my 42-year-old boyfriend for almost a year and a half, and in my life I have never had an orgasm. Personal information, I know, but I feel like perhaps the sexual difficulties that women have could be related to a misunderstanding of our sexual health in allopathic medicine. I believe there are a million of us struggling, and I desperately want to be able to share this expression of love and life with my partner. Thanks for any help you can offer on women's sexual health care and well-being, and thanks for being so amazing. Well, thank you, Kate, for the compliments, and let's start off with a little-known statistic which I think may shock some people in the audience, which is, and it comes from a very well-researched book that came out in the 80s called The Height Report, and the statistic is that 95% of women, when asked in a private confidential interview, will cop to having faked an orgasm. And so I don't know if that's there are now guys out there in the audience going, oh, that's never happened to me, but I would urge them to rethink their stance. Now, there's many reasons that the female orgasm is more difficult than the male orgasm, and we're going to start off with the fact of emotional override. This is something that is critical in women. In our emailer here, Kate, she's madly in love with her boyfriend, but we have to first stop and think about what about reflex emotions that may be coming up for a woman when she has sex. And so these could be feelings of anger, resentment, and more importantly, they could be buried feelings from early childhood experience. Another statistic that I found shocking when I read it is that 1 in 4 to 5 women have been raped, and 1 in 5 or 1 in 10, depending on the literature that you look at, individuals in the population have been sexually abused as children. One of the effects of sexual abuse is to change the meaning of the sex act in the brain into something very different. And so I believe personally that many of those non-orgasmic women out there may have had some early childhood or some early experiences that set them on the wrong road. A second issue is anatomy. And I have to say that doctors are not taught anatomy of the woman's neurologic plexus in medical school. I had no training whatsoever in how an orgasm happens. Very minimal sort of, well, there's the sacral plexus and stimulation from the sacral plexus goes to the spinal column and triggers a reflex. And that was pretty much it. And that's a pretty poor description of an extremely complex process. The anatomy of the female vagina is a little bit like a penis turned inside out, if you will, and lining the interior of the vagina. So the tip of the penis, the more sensitive part, becomes the clitoris. The rest of the skin is essentially the lining of the uterus. So you can sort of imagine grabbing the sleeve of your coat and turning the sleeve inside out. But what we do not study is the fact that the nerves cross at the top. In other words, they cross at the cervix and the lower uterus, which contracts during an orgasm. But more importantly, when we do a hysterectomy, when we do certain cervical procedures like cones, we actually damage this nerve plexus. And in some women, the damage is substantial enough that they lose their orgasms completely after a hysterectomy, after having been completely orgasmically competent prior to that. And this is a little known, generally not discussed, and fairly common complication of hysterectomy. So we have to think twice about that, and very quietly, now that we have a majority of doctors, not a majority of doctors in gynecology who are female, but getting close to a majority, we're starting to rethink some of the surgical procedures, and there's now this thing called cervix preservation hysterectomy, and that preserves that nerve plexus, and we're not seeing as much of that complication as before. So if you're a person who knows someone or you yourself are contemplating a hysterectomy, that's certainly something that you want to look into. So people who are having difficulty with orgasm and are, even though they're in love, need to spend a lot of time on sensate focus. This basically involves what was traditionally called foreplay, but most sex therapies involve doing first just body-to-body contact, kissing, touching of other sensitive tissues such as nipples and lips, and then working your way up to external stimulation of the pelvis and gradually working your way up to anything further involving penetration. It's extremely important to go very, very slow in an individual who's having difficulty. And unfortunately, expectations on the part of our society is that this is just supposed to happen automatically. I might add that if you were learning how to have sex from internet porn, you do not know how to have sex. And if you were learning how you are supposed to be responding as a woman from internet porn, then you're probably faking it. That's, I think, all we need to say on the subject, except that there is therapy out there. It is something that a person like Kate should be and is being encouraged to seek out. She needs a thorough examination gynecologically to make sure that that there are no anatomic structures getting in her way. And then she needs someone who can work with her and her partner carefully to help them get past what barriers, whether they be psychological, reflex, or simply skill level on the part of the male partner, need to be overcome. The next email is from Rabia in Medford, presumably Oregon. I have a polycystic ovarian syndrome, and I've not had a menstrual cycle since I was about 12. I'm 18, and I recently started NuvaRing and felt a lot better. Now that I've taken it out at the end of the first month, I had menstruation, but now I have acne or an allergic reaction. I'm not sure which. I don't know what steps to take. I definitely don't want to deal with a breakout all over my face every month, especially if the cycle is artificial. What would you suggest? Well, the first thing to do is, Rabia, is to get tested for your levels of DHEA and testosterone, because you may have a problem processing sex hormones. This means that the NuvaRing, which is full of sex hormones that are soaking into your tissue, is responsible for your acne. I think that's highly likely. And it means that you may have a detoxification issue around estrogen and progesterone, and possibly testosterone as well. These can be due to some genetic variants. They are also heavily influenced by diet. One of the best dietary things to do is lots of the cruciferous vegetables, and that's your broccoli sprouts are especially rich in this, kale, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, watercress. These are other cruciferous vegetables that change the way your body processes the estrogen and the progesterone and can help with the acne. Another thing that people usually have when they have polycystic ovaries is they have elevated levels of insulin resistance and higher levels of insulin. So an agent that helps with that called metformin, M-E-T-F-O-R-M-I-N, is often very useful to help with the Stein-Leventhal syndrome, and the periods spontaneously arise. It's important that you have been checked for your prolactin levels, as that can also interfere with periods and fertility. And ultimately, our goal to get you cycling normally is to restore your fertility, which it probably is even more important than keeping your skin clear, at least in the long run. But for you, what I would suggest is maybe getting those blood tests and then pursuing the metformin rather than just artificially creating menstrual cycles, which really doesn't get to the root of the problem. It's almost sort of a cosmetic thing at that point. And you're listening to KSCO. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, and we're going to go to our first caller. And let's see, that is Steve in Aptos. Hello, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Steve.
I wanted to ask about my wife's sexual health after her hysterectomy.
Yes, go ahead.
It's been about 2-3 years, and she's pretty much all just not feeling it. She was, before that, she was extremely sexual and sexually responsive.
All right.
Now there's kind of nothing. She's on an estrogen patch, but there's still no difference.
Okay.
No desire and ticklish. Not the right response.
So let me ask you: was she postmenopausal at the time of the hysterectomy?
No, she went through a period of tremendous bleeding. That's why they chose to do that.
Okay. And did her ovaries remain?
I believe so.
All right. Unfortunately, it's very common after a hysterectomy for the ovaries to die off quickly. And we think this has to do with possibly the nerves affecting the nerves that are removed, affecting the blood supply. But it's a very strong statistical association. So that may be part of the difficulty, is that the ovaries, many people don't realize this, the ovaries also make testosterone. They only make about a tenth as much as the testicles do. But that 10% in women is enough to have a profound effect on libido. So the first thing out of the box to do is to check her testosterone levels and to supplement them if she isn't getting, if she has low levels of testosterone. As long as a person is on an estrogen patch, they can use a small amount of testosterone and not have any side effects like growing hair and developing acne. Once you get the testosterone levels up to the normal level of, say, a 40-year-old woman, and we have a range of what's considered normal, if her libido doesn't come back or she hasn't noticed any improvement in the situation, then I would actually suggest that the hysterectomy itself may have injured the nerve plexus, and that's that may be it for the orgasms. But desire and orgasms are not the same thing. So hopefully, with a supplementation of hormones, you can get back to the point where there is interest. Because I think for women, the interest is and the just basic pleasure of sex. Let's say, since we don't always consistently have orgasm, or at least most of us don't, we still enjoy sex. With a man, it's more of an imperative, I think, although our Chinese medicine colleagues would say that a man who allows himself to have an orgasm every time he has sex is probably shortening his life. So we'll leave that for another conversation.
Was she occasionally, it's getting further and further apart now, but she will have clitoral orgasm.
Okay, and the clitoral orgasm is the differentiation that actually Freud invented, and many people would argue that it's really not a different kind of orgasm, you know, one in the clitoris and one in the uterus or vagina, but just a matter of, kind of like the sort of wet dream, no big deal orgasm versus for a man versus the, oh my God, you know, the heavens have opened orgasm. And I'm sure you experience in your life, you know, big ones and little ones, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm not sure if it's a matter of different types of orgasms or different levels of degree, but I find that actually encouraging that there's probably a road back. And I suspect that road back is going to involve using testosterone, sometimes applying testosterone to the clitoris on a regular basis. And you can only do this in women who are taking hormone supplements, but that's a kind of an alternative medicine thing that's done quite commonly. Our own local compounding pharmacies make that up, and you just need a prescription from your doctor. They also supply on their website a doctor's information sheet about this, and so you could go and get that, and she could walk into her doctor's office and say, hey, can I try this? Here's the dose. Make an X here and sign it and send it off to the pharmacy for me, and let me give this a shot.
So it's not like the estrogen patch. This would be testosterone applied directly?
Yeah, yeah, a little tiny bit, dilute. But it's, and I don't know if it's placebo effect. I've not seen a double-blind study where, you know, you give women an inert cream and tell them, rub your clitoris with this every day, and you give other women the testosterone and say, rub your clitoris with this every day. Maybe it's the rubbing your clitoris every day that does the trick. I don't really know. But I do, like I said, monitor testosterone levels and make sure I get those up to the normal range. And clearly in cases where I do that, I do see improvement in libido, in desire, as opposed to orgasm. And then it's important to differentiate the two.
Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for the call. Bye-bye now. This email from Marty in Auburn, California. And Marty writes, let's see, low-dose naltrexone. Hi, Dr. Don. I hear a lot about LDN for cancer and autoimmune problems. What's the latest about this? Best wishes, Marty. Well, Marty, this is a really interesting alternative world treatment that I actually employ for people who have autoimmune disease, particularly because it's way cheaper than the biologicals. And this is an agent that is approved by the FDA for long-term use at a dose of 50, that's 50 milligrams a day. So if 50 milligrams a day is safe, then it stands to reason that 4.5 milligrams a day is probably also safe. And at that level, this is acting probably more like a neurotransmitter or attaching to receptors on the white blood cells. You see, we know that there are opiate receptors on all of the cells of the immune system, and that the endorphins, which are your pleasure hormones and also hormones that block pain, that these endorphins influence immune function. So that's kind of intriguing, and we're undoubtedly exploiting this by using a drug that is what's called an agonist-antagonist. So this drug was developed for use for opiate overdose. And when a person overdoses on heroin, if you give them a shot of this, it fills the receptors that the heroin is bouncing on and off of and prevents the heroin, which activates these receptors and causes the respiratory depression, which is what people with overdose die of. They stop breathing. So you stop that and you reverse the effect. So small doses of this have a morphine-like activity. Large doses block morphine. So what we're doing really is we're giving a hormonal type feedback onto the white blood cells and calming the immune system down in cases of autoimmune disease. I'm actually not in favor of using low-dose naltrexone for cancer. And my reasoning is exactly what I just said. I feel the evidence is excellent, and I feel the physiology is plausible that this modulates the immune system, and I haven't seen studies showing that it actually helps cancer, and I'm a little worried that it might actually interfere with the immune system's attack on the cancer cells, which is a critical step in getting rid of cancer. an immunosuppressed individual, it doesn't really matter how much chemo you throw at them. Unless those white cells come back and start doing their surveillance, we're going to run into trouble. This is, in fact, one of the major paradoxes of our current cancer therapy, is that a lot of the drugs that we use are immune suppressants. And that kind of doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. And this one from Eve in Kanab, Utah. Dear Dr. Don, are there any of the home-use radiofrequency skin-tightening gadgets any good? Can you review some things that work in both the office and at home for slowing down the aging process on skin, besides, of course, diet, exercise, and lowering stress? And let's not forget sunscreen, Eve, because that's the biggest contributor to skin aging there is ultraviolet radiation. So electrofrequency works really well for tightening tissues if you get a needle in there and actually cook the tissues. But the radio frequency home gadgets are pretty much bogus, in my opinion. I don't think that the effects are anything more than temporary fluid fluxes into the tissues. Basically, you're causing the cells to leak and the capillaries to leak, and you're getting a little bit of tissue leak, and that's helping. But I don't believe it works. Fluid, making sure you're well hydrated, and mild regular skin injury. So things like microtrauma, microdermabrasion, some of the laser treatments work. I think that there's a very, very low energy laser home product that may have some studies that show some benefit. The poor man's way is to buy finishing sandpaper. No, I'm not kidding you. But if you're going to do a French polish sanding, you know, the woodworker would be able to tell you about that. There's this very, 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 very fine grit sandpaper called finishing sandpaper. And you very, very carefully sand your face with this. You don't want to break the skin. You don't want to bleed. But just the light sanding, you should feel a little bit sore afterwards. The retinoids like Retin-A, which is tretinoin, very effective because they cause a mild skin injury, and your skin should feel a little sore, but it shouldn't look red. But microtrauma is actually the best anti-aging thing that you might be able to manage at home, but you have to be careful because you can, in fact, injure yourself. So you want to go slow and maybe practice on the skin of your forearm, which is similar to the skin of your face, before you go anywhere. Let's go to our next caller, Judith, on the air. Hello, Judith. Are you there?
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Thank you. Yes, I'm in my mid-60s. I had open-heart surgery on my lungs, a pulmonary endarterectomy.
Oh, my goodness.
Take out the blood clots in 2012 that were near my heart. Yeah. I was told I had a fatal lung disease in 2008, and I wasn't going for it, but I was lucky. Okay, so I went to Stanford. They said, have you heard of that surgery?
Anyway, oh, yes, but endarterectomies are fraught with risk because you can get clots breaking off and going elsewhere, like the brain. So how did you well with yours?
I didn't have any complications. I got out of the hospital as soon as possible. That was part of the reason, because they didn't have very good aftercare, I'm sorry to say. It's typical, I'm sure. So I've been lucky, but I've had a difficult recovery, so it's 5 years later. I've had insomnia issues, but I had this is the deal now, cut to the chase. I had this minor, well, it wasn't minor, a cough since last year. And I'm aware that we're being sprayed with lots of chemicals, and we call it the chemtrail flu. Well, I came down with that on March 20th, where I was just hit with this horrible infection in my chest, my bronchial tubes. And my question is, I've wiped out, I still have the fatigue and the cough. I have extreme, you know, I'm just wondering if you have any tricks. There's lots of YouTubes that have tricks and things, and I do a lot of supplementation. So I was thinking about ordering some food-grade hydrogen peroxide, 33%, because I took that when I was in my late 20s and 30s to cure my candidiasis. So I'll shut up now and just hear what you want to tell me.
Okay, so our goal here is to help you manage your cough. Is that, have I got
that
right?
Yeah, yes, and you do acknowledge that there is a lot of people having this so-called chemtrail flu, right? You don't have a fever, you just have this clamminess and, you know, fatigue and all, it's horrible. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's all right. I think there's stuff going on in the environment. All right, I'm not sure it's the stuff I see in the sky. I don't want to get into a debate about that. Let's talk about what we do about it, because obviously wherever it's coming from, it's something. And this stuff is additive. I think this is the first thing that I want to emphasize. It's a cumulative burden, and you've sustained with the endarterectomy. You've got some you had some injury to the lung. And some injury to the lung blood. And I'm going to drop into I'm going to drop out of Western medical mode for a moment and just talk about how the Chinese medicine world thinks about the lung. And the important thing here is the flow of qi. So when we breathe, we're breathing in a form of qi called oxygen. And that oxygen has to be transported into our blood and then move throughout our body. And you had a injury to the blood movement in your lung. You had a blood clot, and then when that clot was removed, there is residual scarring and damage in the artery. But this is energetically also going to influence the lung blood from a deeper way, in an energetic way. So think of it in terms of reflexes. So now you have a reflex cough. The cough itself irritates the lung passageways and creates more cough. And so you've got a loop. What I would love to be able to do, but it probably wouldn't be covered by your insurance, I'd love to be able to have someone suck out some of the phlegm from down in your bronchioles and look for eosinophils, which are a type of allergic cell, to see if those were elevated, because I bet that what we would find is that you are now sensitized to environmental antigens, and the top two are house dust and fungus, and we are in mold central here in this part of the Monterey Bay.
Yes.
And so it's almost a given that you have some mold issues, whether in your house.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a given. So trying to get rid of some of the toxics that are in your environment, what I would have you do, number one, is get a HEPA filter.
Yeah.
Get it on the vacuum cleaner and get a negative ionizer.
So, I know, I was just thinking that.
Yeah,
my mother used to use those in the 60s, I'm not kidding.
No, they actually, have to wipe down the walls.
I know, okay. Yeah,
okay, so you got to put on your N95 mask. So that you don't. That's the kind of mask that'll grab those small particles, and you can buy it in any hardware store, because people who use aerosol paint should use it. And
I have those.
They're the thicker ones, and they have usually a little blue disc in the front of the mask. And so those N95 masks, you're going to want, when you're cleaning the walls and vacuuming, you're going to actually want to take some tape and tape it around your chin and your nose so that you actually have a seal, because you are stirring up a lot of particle. But you need to be cleaning the particles out of your environment. That will help some. You should think about going down to maybe Five Branches, the local acupuncture clinic.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have a sliding scale. They're not expensive. And what you want is see one of the herbal people and have them look at your tongue and your pulses and figure out whether you have a problem with your lung qi or a problem with your lung blood or both, and then give you an herb for that.
Oh, nice.
And that will help restore the flow. It'll help damp down the reflex. There's also some acupuncture points. I use one called Lung 6, and you can look that up on the internet and find a kind of an atlas, and it'll tell you how to find Lung 6. And if you can get into Lung 6, have the doctor mark it on your arm while you're in the acupuncture clinic and practice finding it on yourself, then you can just push on that with a blunt stick, and it'll reduce that urge and help you step out of this loop. Okay? So moistening, essentially, we'd love to moisten your lung tissues. We need to do that internally, because externally, if we try to give you a humidifier, it's going to aggravate the mold problem, and we'll take two steps backwards for every half step forward we take with your lungs. So we have to overcome that reflex, and I have found acupuncture and Chinese medicine to be a much more effective strategy for that than the one that we have in Western medicine, which is basically beta blockers. I mean, you should be checked for asthma and make sure that you don't have cough variant asthma, but that's a simple spirometry test, and you might want to get that work up anyway as part of your approach. The fact is, you dodged a major bullet, and you know it.
But when I got the surgery,
when you didn't die outright from the blood clot in your lung. Actually,
I'm very blessed, lucky or something.
You're here, but you're here for a reason. And
yeah,
so,
thank you.
And so I hope you figured out what that is.
Oh, yes, thank you.
And, and so go forward. But I know this is inconvenient and difficult for you. Other detoxification strategies that I want to put out there for you, because I will be swatted by the alternative community.
Yes.
If I don't mention saunas. And
saunas, I'm not finished.
Yeah, saunas. Because you can sweat, you can sweat out toxins.
Yes.
You can sweat out toxins.
Very good.
Sweating is very good. Now you have to be hydrated, of course, but sweating will help remove toxins, and it may be a little tricky for you to do it in a.
No, I have a gym that has one, actually, I believe.
Okay, but I'm wondering if the dry air may give you a problem. So you may need to be breathing through a wet. You might have to basically wear a wet washcloth over your face.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I get so exhausted.
Yeah, well, try it. Breathe through a wet rag and see if that helps with not coughing.
Sauna.
Yeah, while you're in the sauna.
What about swimming? I hate to interrupt you, though.
Swimming is a problem because about 2 inches above the pool, there's all these chlorine gas.
I know.
And so... if you're going to swim, I would swim with a snorkel and just head down, because then the snorkel will get the air above, we'll get it up a little higher, but it really depends. There is a saltwater pool over at Cabrillo Fitness. And so if you can find a pool that's either low chlorine or no chlorine, then I think swimming could be very beneficial.
That's why I've put it off a little bit. Thank you.
Yeah.
But
again,
I'm determined to get back, because that's what I did as a child. I didn't tell you about my weak thighs, my legs. My legs are so weak right now, I'm terrified that I might lose them. So I'm not terrified. I'm not going to be terrified. I'm just saying, I need to get on my legs.
You need to get on your legs, right.
I haven't done enough exercise, and I've spent a lot of time online, so I'm sitting on my, you know what.
Yes. Well.
But that's going to change. I'm determined.
All right. All right. Well,
thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I interrupted you, though, and I'm sorry.
No,
I shouldn't have done that.
No, that's all right. People interrupt me all the time.
I know, but I didn't want to interrupt you. Your next thought was...
Well, we talked about...
Acupuncture is just amazing. Before my surgery, I had some done on my... And it just amazed me. Like this Dr. Lang, she knew what she was doing, Raven Lang.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
But,
very good.
Yeah, I used to go to Five Branches all the time, and that's really good advice. Thank you.
Yeah, go back down there and have them look into...
That's
chi stagnation or blood stagnation would be where I would start. And that's, you don't diagnose Chinese medicine over the radio any more than you do dermatology for the same reasons.
Hey, you gave me so much more information. I mean, information about the lungs is just hard to find. I've been sort of scared to push it, but yeah, I'll go to the gym. Okay, I'll let you go now. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and thank you for the call, Judith.
Okay.
Feel free to call back in with more questions some other time.
I will.
Bye-bye. Lots of emails from Utah lately. Eve in Kanab writes, elevation sickness. Dr. Don, I live in the high desert, and no matter how long I live here, I can't seem to totally adjust to the elevation. Any suggestions? Well, yes, Eve, I actually do have a suggestion. And this is an old-fashioned drug called acetolazide, and it is a trade name Diamox. And this is kind of a diuretic, but it helps with mountain sickness. We often give it preventatively for people, and it's something that you can take as a low dose long-term. You do have to watch your potassium levels, but that's easily done. So think about that. Doing that, and we'll see if that low dose is about a quarter of the dose that we use for acute mountain sickness, or you could use the full treatment dose for a few days and then move to the other dose. So let's see. We've got Brian on line one. I think I got you on the air, Brian. Are you there?
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, hear you just fine.
All right. I want to ask you about levothyroxine. Is there another way to help someone with a an older woman with a thyroid condition other than that medicine? Is there a better way, safer way?
Well, it depends on the clinical circumstances, of course. But that being said, medical treatment for low thyroid generally involves giving levothyroxine, which is commercially available and is the standard of care, and expecting the body to turn it into active thyroid, which is leothyronine. And the body doesn't always, we make this assumption that that's going to happen. And when you actually look and see if it's happening, it often isn't. And so you can be throwing lots of thyroid at a person, lots of levothyroxine, which is the about 90% of what your thyroid gland puts out, and the other 10% is active thyroid. And that active, if you can't take the inactive storage form, the levothyroxine, and turn it into active thyroid, it's not going to work. And then you start giving higher and higher doses, and that can lead to osteoporosis and palpitations, and still not fix the metabolism and the energy. So if what I usually do is I use the natural thyroid, which is about, it's animal derived, so I can't do it in vegans, but there is synthetic stuff. But really what we're trying to do is we're trying to replicate what the gland does, 10% active, 90% storage, and send that into the bloodstream. Most people will respond a little better to that, and I can get away with using lower doses, which is safer for the heart. Now, too much thyroid or too little thyroid are both bad for the heart, and the older you get, the more vulnerable your heart is. So that's generally my approach. So I think that is safer, but you will find that that is a minority opinion, and that many regular physicians who have not done any alternative training will be very uncomfortable using natural thyroid, because they get their education from the drug companies who tell them, oh, that's, you know, that's not biologically consistent from dose to dose, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, there's pretty good quality control for this stuff anymore. And I don't see that as an issue, but that's always the big claim. And especially with thyroid, bioavailability is an issue. And we know that. So it has. So you've got to be sure that you're buying a brand name like Nature Thyroid or Armour, and not, you know, the cheapest version you can possibly find. I hope that's helpful for you.
Very, very helpful. Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.